Section 5, Killing and Atrocities. No honor here, no virtue. Quote, the basic aim of a nation at war is establishing an image of the enemy in order to distinguish as sharply as possible the act of killing from the act of murder. Glenn Gray, The Warriors. Atrocity can be defined as the killing of a non-combatant, either an erstwhile combatant who is no longer fighting or has given up, or a civilian. But modern war, and particularly guerrilla warfare, makes such distinctions blurry. Atrocity has always been part of war, and in order to understand war, we must understand atrocity. Let us begin to understand it by examining the full spectrum of atrocity. Chapter 1. The Full Spectrum of Atrocity. We often think of Nazi atrocities in World War II as all having been committed by psychopaths or sadistic killers. But there is a fortuitous shortage of such individuals in society. In reality, the problem of distinguishing murder from killing in combat is extremely complex. If we examine atrocity as a spectrum of occurrences rather than a precisely defined type of occurrence, then perhaps we can better understand the nature of the phenomenon. This spectrum is intended to address only individual personal kills and will leave out the indiscriminate killing of civilians caused by bombs and artillery. Slaying the noble enemy. Anchoring one end of the spectrum of atrocity is the act of killing an armed enemy who is trying to kill you. This end of the spectrum is not atrocity at all, but serves as a standard against which other kinds of killing can be measured. The enemy who fights to a noble death validates and affirms the killer's belief in his own nobility and the glory of his cause. Thus, a World War I British officer could speak admiringly to Holmes of German machine gunners who remained faithful unto death. Topping fellows, fight until they are killed. They gave us hell. And T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia, immortalized in prose the German units who stood firm against his Arab forces during the rout of the Turkish army in World War I. I grew proud of the enemy who had killed my brothers. They were 2,000 miles from home, without hope and without guides, in conditions bad enough to break the bravest nerves. Yet their sections held together, shearing through the rack of Turk and Arab like armored ships, high-faced and silent. When attacked, they halted, took position, fired to order. There was no haste, no crying, no hesitation. They were glorious. These are noble kills, which place the minimum possible burden on the conscience of the killer. And thus the soldier is able to further rationalize his kill by honoring his fallen foes, thereby gaining stature and peace by virtue of the nobility of those he has slain. Gray areas, ambushes and guerrilla warfare. Many kills in modern combat are ambushes and surprise attacks, in which the enemy represents no immediate threat to the killer, but is killed anyway, without opportunity to surrender. Steve Banko provides an excellent example of such a kill. They didn't know I existed, but I sure as hell saw them. This is one effed up way to die, I thought, as I squeezed softly on the trigger. Such a kill is by no means considered an atrocity, but it is also distinctly different from a noble kill, and potentially harder for the killer to rationalize and deal with. Until the 20th century, such ambush kills were extremely rare in combat, and many civilizations particularly protected themselves and their conscience and mental health by declaring such forms of warfare dishonorable. One of the things that could make combat in Vietnam and a generation later in Afghanistan and Iraq particularly traumatic was that due to the nature of guerrilla warfare, soldiers were often placed in situations where the line between combatant and non-combatant was blurred. For the tense battle-primed GIs ordered to seal off the village, the often subtle nuances and indicators used by interrogators to identify VC from civilian, combatant from non-combatant, were a luxury they felt they could not afford. The decision, VC or not VC, often had to be reached in a split second and was compounded by the language barrier. The consequences of any ambiguity sometimes proved fatal to Vietnamese villagers. In Binh Suc, one unit of American soldiers, crouching near a road leading out of the village, were on a lookout for VC. A Vietnamese man approached their position on a bicycle. He wore black pajamas, the peasant outfit adopted by the VC. As he rode 20 yards past the point where he first came into view, a machine gun crackled some 30 yards in front of him. The man tumbled dead in a muddy ditch. One soldier grimly commented, "That's a VC for you. He's a VC, all right." That's what they wear. He was leaving town. He had to have some reason. Major Charles Malloy added, What are you going to do when you spot a guy in black pajamas? Wait for him to get out his automatic weapon and start shooting? I'm telling you, I'm not. The soldiers never found out whether the Vietnamese was VC or not. Such was the perplexity of a war in which the enemy was not a foreign force, but lived and fought among the people. Edward Doyle, Three Battles. As we read the words of these men, we can place ourselves in their shoes and understand what they are saying. They were men trained to kill in a tense situation. They had no real need to justify their actions. So why did they try so hard? That's a VC for you. He's a VC, all right. That's what they wear. He was leaving town. He had to have some reason. It may be that what we are hearing here is someone trying desperately to justify his actions to himself. He has been placed in a situation in which he has been forced to take these kinds of actions, maybe even make these kinds of mistakes, and he needs desperately to have someone tell him that what he did was right and necessary. Sometimes it was even more difficult. For example, consider the situation that this U.S. Army helicopter pilot found himself in Vietnam. Off to our left, we could see a couple of downed Huey helicopters inside the paddy. Strangely, just as I reached the center of the hub, I noticed an old lady standing almost dead center of the hub, casually planting rice. Still zigzagging, I looked back over my shoulder at her trying to figure out what she was doing there. Was she crazy, or just determined not to let the war interfere with his schedule? Glancing again at the burning Hueys, it dawned on me what she was doing out there, and I turned back. "Shoot the old woman, Hal," I yelled. But Hal, the door gunner, who had been busy on his own side of the chopper, had not seen her before and looked at me as if I had gone crazy. So we passed her without firing, and I zigzagged around the paddies, dodging sniper fire, while it filled Hal in. "She has a 360-degree view over the trees around the village, Hal," I yelled. "The machine gunners are watching her, and when she sees Hueys coming, she faces them, and they concentrate their fire over that spot. That's why so many are down around here. She's a goddamn weather vane for them. Shoot her!" Hal gave me a thumbs up, and I turned to make another pass. But Jerry and Paul, in another helicopter, had caught onto her also and had put her down. For some reason, as I again passed over our burning Hueys, I could not feel anything but relief at the old woman's death. D. Bray, prowling for POWs. Was the woman being forced to do what she was doing? Was she truly a Viet Cong sympathizer or a victim? Were Viet Cong weapons being held on her or her family? And would anyone have done any differently than these pilots under the circumstances? Possibly. But possibly they would not have lived to tell about it if they had done differently. Certainly no one will ever prosecute these men. And most certainly they will have to live with these kinds of doubts for the rest of their lives. Sometimes the trauma associated with these gray area killings in modern combat can be tremendous. Look, I didn't like to kill people, but I've killed Arabs. Note the unconscious dehumanizing of the enemy. Maybe I'll tell you a story. A car came towards us in the middle of the Lebanese war, without a white flag. 5 minutes before, another car had come, and there were four Palestinians with rocket-propelled grenades in it, killed three of my friends. So this new Peugeot comes towards us, and we shoot. And there was a family there, three children, and I cried. But I couldn't take the chance. It's a real problem. Children, father, mother, all the family was killed. But we couldn't take the chance. Gavi Bashan, Israeli reservist in Lebanon, 1982, quoted in Gwyn Dyer, War. Once again, we see killing in modern warfare, in an age of guerrillas and terrorists, as increasingly moving from black and white to shades of gray. And as we continue down the atrocity spectrum, we will see a steady fade to black. Dark areas, slaying the ignoble enemy. The close-range murder of prisoners and civilians during war is a demonstrably counterproductive action. Executing enemy prisoners stiffens the will of the enemy and makes him less likely to surrender. Yet, in the heat of battle, it happens quite often. Several of the Vietnam veterans I interviewed said, without detailed explanation, that they never took prisoners. Often in school and training situations when it is impractical to take prisoners during operations behind enemy lines, there is an unspoken agreement that the prisoners have to be taken care of. But in the heat of battle, it is not really all that simple. In order to fight at close range, one must deny the humanity of one's enemy. Surrender requires the opposite, that one recognize and take pity on the humanity of the enemy. A surrender in the heat of battle requires a complete and very difficult emotional turnaround by both parties. The enemy who opts to posture or fight and then dies in battle becomes a noble enemy. but if at the last minute he tries to surrender, he runs a great risk of being killed immediately. Holmes writes at length on this process. Surrendering during battle is difficult. Charles Carrington suggested, no soldier can claim a right to quarter if he fights to the extremity. T.P. Mark saw 7 German machine gunners shot. They were defenseless, but they had chosen to make themselves so. We did not ask them to abandon their guns. They only did so when they saw that those who were not mown down were getting closer to them, and the boot was now on the other foot. Ernst Younger agreed that the defender had no moral right to surrender in these circumstances. The defending force, after driving their bullets into the attacking one at 5 paces distance, must take the consequences. A man cannot change his feelings again during the last rush with a veil of blood before his eyes. He does not want to take prisoners but to kill. During the cavalry charge in Moselle in 1914, Sergeant James Taylor of the 9th Lancers saw how difficult it was to restrain excited men. Then there was a bit of a melee, horses neighing and a lot of yelling and shouting. I remember seeing Corporal Bolt run his lance right through a dismounted German who had his hands up and thinking that it was a rather bad thing to do. Harold Dearden, a medical officer on the Western Front, read a letter written by a young soldier to his mother. When we jumped into the trench, mother, they all held up their hands and shouted, "Comrade, comrade," and that means I give in their language. But they had to have it, mother. I think that is all from your loving Albert. No soldier who fights until his enemy is at close small arms range in any war has more than perhaps a 50-50 chance of being granted quarter. If he stands up to surrender, he risks being shot with the time-honored comment, "Too late, chum." If he lies low, he will fall victim to the grenades of the mopping-up party, in no mood to take chances. Yet Holmes concludes that the consistently remarkable thing in such circumstances is not how many soldiers are killed while trying to surrender, but how few. Even under this kind of provocation, the general resistance to killing runs true. Surrender executions are clearly wrong and counterproductive to a force that has dedicated itself to fighting in a fashion that the nation and the soldiers can live with after battle. They are, however, completed in the heat of battle and are rarely prosecuted. It is only the individual soldier who must hold himself accountable for his actions most of the time. Executions in cold blood are another matter entirely. Black areas, executions. Execution is defined here as the close-range killing of a non-combatant, civilian or POW, who represents no significant or immediate military or personal threat to the killer. The effect of such kills on the killer is intensely traumatic, since the killer has limited internal motivation to kill the victim and kills almost entirely out of external motivations. The close range of the kill severely hampers the killer in his attempts to deny the humanity of the victim and severely hampers denial of personal responsibility for the kill. Jim Morris is an ex-Green Beret and a Vietnam veteran turned writer. Here he interviews an Australian veteran of the Malaysian counterinsurgency who is trying to live with the memory of an execution. His story is entitled Killers in Retirement. No heroes, no villains, just mates. This time we leaned against a wall on the opposite side of the room. He leaned forward, speaking softly and earnestly. This time there was no pretense. Here was a man bearing his soul. We attacked a terrorist prison camp and took a woman prisoner. She must have been high up in the party. She wore the tabs of a commissar. I'd already told my men that we took no prisoners, but I'd never killed a woman. She must die quickly. We must leave, my sergeant said. Oh, God, I was sweating, Harry went on. She was magnificent. What's the matter, Mr. Ballantyne, she asked. You're sweating. Not for you, I said. It's a malaria recurrence. I gave my pistol to my sergeant, but he shook his head. None of them would do it. And if I didn't, I'd never be able to control that unit again. You're sweating, Mr. Ballantyne, she said again. Not for you, I said. Did you kill her? Hell, I blew her effing head off, he replied. My platoon all gathered round and smiled. You are a Tuan, Malay for sir or leader. My sergeant said, you are a Tuan. I'm not a priest. I'm not even an officer anymore. I hope my look told Harry that I liked him, that it was okay with me if he forgave himself. It's hard to do, though. This is the spectrum of atrocity. This is how atrocity happens, but not why. Let us now examine the why of atrocity, the rationale of atrocity, and the dark power that atrocity lends to those who wield it.